All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Welcome to episode number 38 of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am joined yet again by Liam Flynn and also by the regular post-sabbatical James Allen, or he's kind of mid-sabbatical. I'm not really sure how it's going to work, but he's back and we're glad to have him back to chirps in with the footy and the boxing stuff this week. How's it going, lads? Sorry.
My phone just hopped into the fucking convo then. Sorry, but that's a great start to my return, and it's a big one.
Yeah. Happy to be back. Cheers for having us.
The preamble rumble this week is an NFL one. So this happened on early Tuesday morning. So Las Vegas Raiders wide receiver Henry Ruggs is charged on two felony offences for driving under the influence and causing death to another driver. So a bit pretty deep one, man. This is a kind of a endemic of the sport of American football. Police said his Chevy Corvette he was operating crashed at high speed into the back of a Toyota RAV4, killing both the woman driver and her dog. The incident occurred early hours Tuesday morning, and he's since been released by the Raiders organization. The 22-year-old becomes the fourth active NFL player over the last 25 years to be involved in a DUI incident resulting in death. You know, this is obviously something that's been happening in the NFL, not just once, but it's happened four times in the last 25 years. What are your stances on this? I want to get your opinion first, Jim.
Do you think that's like at high numbers? Those like four in the past 25 years. Do you reckon that's high?
If you think about percentages of like, you know, proportionate into how many people are like, I don't know the figures. I ain't got the figures, but like you're thinking about how often does this happen in the world? Like how many deaths from DUI offenses are there in America every year?
Well, I was thinking basically like if it was a high number, I think there's a couple of contributing factors. Obviously, they're student athletes. So from day one, they've got a heightened idea of being able to just do whatever they want. So especially in small towns in America and stuff like that, they're like hero worship, even through high school, college. And then if you're one of the few that actually make it to the NFL, that just carries on, doesn't it? And then obviously you get CTE, which is like diminished responsibility, increased risk taking, all that kind of stuff. So if it was disproportionately high in NFL players, I wouldn't be surprised. But those numbers themselves don't sound that high, even though, like you, I don't really have a grip on the figures.
If I had to do this research, I would say that seems like a high amount, because how many NFL players are there in a 25-year span? That's a tiny proportion of the population over that time, isn't there? So I would say it would be disproportionately higher in terms of these players. So, and not only that, all right, so let's just say, take the figures aside, these NFL players, like, they've got an NFL hotline, right, that they can just call on a whim. Just come pick me up and take me to where I need to go for free. That each state, each American state has a hotline for those players to be able to do that. So there's literally no excuses, man.
I agree with you there. That point, I've never heard that before. So they can just call a number and a black van will come and pick them up wherever they are.
Whoa, it doesn't have to be black, mate. Chill out.
I'm just reading what's here. there's no excuse. There's no excuse for doing something like drink driving when you've got a service like that. But I was interested in your point there, Jim. I think there's a lot to be said about this messiah complex they probably grow up with, being these heroes in these college football teams as student athletes. But I think there's a lot to be said for that. That would change your mindset in a drastic way. Maybe they feel invincible. I don't know. But either way, yeah, it's not right.
No, I think that's a great point on both of your behalves. I think that was the idea that was bandied around a little bit today, over the last sort of few days, but I've been listening to on the ESPN radio, that there is a kind of diminished responsibility almost, and like the messiah complex, as if like they can do nothing wrong. Do you know what I mean? So they're literally like, because they've been adored since they're even like a high school. You know what I mean? From the age of 14, 15, as soon as people work out that they're special and they're going to be like a baseball player or a football player, like they're just like paraded with all this, like, you know, congratulations. And even before they start earning money, they're already put on a pedestal by the whole community, aren't they? Some of these towns are from, they've only got like 10,000 people in it. They won't be able to walk around with people like, you know, going up to them wanting autographs, even at the age of 16, 17. So I think there is definitely that idea that they can do no wrong.
Yeah, it's the same with celebrities, singers and all that. How many times did George Michael drive for a fucking hedge before he got done? Do you know what I mean? That was like classic shit. If you've got the resources, I don't see why you'd bother your ass driving other than thinking you're above the law. You've got everything you need at your fingertips. It's just people thinking they can do what they want to do, and tragic circumstances and consequences in this particular instance.
And he was doing 156 mile per hour 2 seconds before the impact.
That's ridiculous, isn't it, man?
Yeah, absolutely outrageous. Do you know what I mean? So, and it's caused the death of, it's caused the loss of a life. So, yeah, I think I don't know what the approach could be in terms of, like, I think the NFL will have to address it. I think it's something that they have to address, because I don't know if there's any other sports that have in the same scenario. Can we just say it's limited to football players, or is it just a byproduct of the fact that these young, because he's only 22 years old, these young athletes are getting thrown too much money and too much glory at such a young age? I don't know. Is there anything comparable? It's tough to say, isn't it? But we'll leave that there and we'll move on. We'll get straight into the sports stuff this week. So we'll start off with the football. Today, Gareth Southgate has released his England World Cup qualifying squad. So we're going to go through this. All the Twitter comments are Southgate out. He's not picking players that are in form. He's a liar, this and that. As every time he releases, he could have won the World Cup. And he could have won the Euros back-to-back. Every time he releases a 25-man squad, people would be like, get him out, man. Get him out. So we're going to look at who can't get a look in and who's holding his family at gunpoint. So some of the outs, Emile Smith-Rowe. What do you think about that, Jim? Because obviously, in the last 7 games, Arsenal have been much better. Did he deserve at least a look in?
You've just encapsulated the whole thing there. He's had a good 7-game stretch for Arsenal. Arsenal have looked good, especially with the beating Leicester 2-0 last week and that. But come on, who would you put him ahead of?
Who would have put him ahead of in that midfield octet? Well, how many is it? No, 6
octet.
No, that's not, that's 8, isn't it? That's 6. Yeah. So James Ward-Prowse, probably. I don't know. Like I was waxing lyrical about him in the last squad, but at the end of the day, you pick players that are in form, and also you're playing Albania and San Marino, man. Like, give players dead games. Yeah, exactly. Give people that want a cap, and then other players, Ben White, another Arsenal player that, you know, we slagged off on this podcast, like 50 million for what? But he's been pretty good last 7 games. He deserves a chance. And he has not got a look in, and he did the last squad. So I'm not sure what Southgate's really playing at. And then obviously you got Jadon Sancho, Marcus Rashford, they've been left out. That's based on form and not getting enough minutes. I've seen people calling for Conor Gallagher. I'm not so sure about that. But just because he scored against Man City, I'm not sure how well he's been playing this season.
That's exactly what they are calling for him. And you know, with Jadon Sancho and Rashford, yeah, I'm a big fan of Rashford. But you think about his game, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, your man missed 6 sitters before he got one. And it was like the emotional momentum more than anything. He's not in the best form of his life. I dare say his attentions are elsewhere with all the social activities and campaigning he's been doing, which is great for people in general and the people in his immediate sphere. But it looks like he's not doing his footballing career any favours at the moment.
Mikel Antonio as well. I've been saying he should have been getting called up. 2 years ago, I was saying he should have been getting call-ups, man. So I think he's like 31, 32 years old. Like, he's West Ham's, I think, all-time top goal scorer now in the Premier League. He was basically a right-back when he first came to West Ham, and they've turned him into a striker, and he's scoring on the regs now. Like, literally, he's been a consistent goal scorer in the Premier League for like 2 years, and he just hasn't been able to get a look in. So I think he's been a bit unfortunate. And some of the guys that have been in, Tyrone Mings, he's been picked. He's been dropped by Villa, man. Dropped. Like, you know what I mean? He can't even get in the Villa team now, and he's still getting picked for England. And what about this one? What about this bombshell, the talisman, Harry Kane? 1 goal and 1 assist in 9 games. What are you saying about that?
We spent the entirety of the Euros saying how shit Kane was. And I think he scored like 4 or 5 goals, had like 2 or 3 assists. But he was playing shit. It's the maddest thing. It's a testament to how well England did, that he played so shit. And they were still able to give him that quality of service. Look, you put their undroppable question mark. I think there has to be a certain number of your squad players that are just mainstays. Do you know what I mean? And you can't solely pick people on form. I mean, Tyron Mings has probably missed out in the past. He's probably including him now just to like give him a little boost in the England setup. It's good to have players who want to be picked and a certain proportion of them who don't know if they're going to be picked. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Harry Maguire and Harry Kane, look, I know they've like been in and out of form. Maguire seems to have taken another dip lately. But yeah, you do have to have mainstays, ideally through the spine of your team, I would argue.
I think, and also you got Aaron Ramsdale that's going to get a chance now. Obviously, I don't think he's going to be thrust straight into the number one position, but he deserves it, I think, based on his recent form. Jude Bellingham, he looks like he's cemented his place for the future, still playing incredible at an incredibly high level for Borussia Dortmund. Jordan Henderson, he's probably on his last legs, any 31, 32, but he's still scoring, man. He's come back into a bit of form, man. He had a lot of injuries last year, but he's doing all right now.
Is it? I don't see it yet with Bellingham. I don't, because obviously I don't watch as much football as you and the lads, but I was watching the highlights, Justin. Other highlights I've seen in the past, he didn't get much of a run out in the summer. Is this another case of me like just underrating him just because everyone's loving him, like Haaland and Mbappe? Or is it like, or is he more subtle? Does he do more artistic things that I'm not going to notice?
Nah, if you look at a highlight reel of what he does on the ball, he does make players look silly. And he's been doing it since he was 16, like playing for Blues against like Bristol City or whatever. But now he's doing it like in a Champions League game against Man City, against Ajax, you know what I mean? So he's consistently balling. Do you know what I mean? He really is. Like, he's scoring goals, he's getting assists. His technique and his skill on the board is fantastic. So I think hopefully he goes to Liverpool. There is rumours that he's going to go to Liverpool. I think that would be good for him to be thrust into the sort of like Premier League spotlight. Do you know what I mean?
So do you ever pay attention to these whipping matches that England put on, like San Marino and Albania? Because I don't like them. Bissett likes them because he loves England. I've never seen someone love England so much. But do you ever catch them, ever?
I never catch them. I love England's heats during the Euros, during the World Cup. And, you know, I listened to a lot of the episodes of the podcast during the whole thing and disagreed with some of Bissett's points quite a bit. Because you were always one of the guys like, fucking Southgate, man, doesn't know what he's doing. And the guy seems to have done the best for us that I've ever seen. But I had a quick question there for you, Bissett, about Jude Bellingham. I remember hearing all the hype, especially from you and all the other guys in Birmingham, him being an ex-Blues player. But we didn't get to see much of him at all in the Euros. Do you think that's going to change for the World Cup?
I would say 100%. Because I don't think he was really... He wasn't quite introduced to the England squad by that point. He was kind of one of those players that you bring along to the squad to get a feel for the locker room and get the sense of the occasion and stuff like that. So it was more of an introductory sort of squad for him, I think, in the Euros. So he didn't really get as many minutes as you would assume. But I think in a year's time, when we're sat here after he's played in the World Cup, I think he'll be a starter. He will be a starter in the next World Cup, I would assume, for England, yeah. Right, should we move on to the footy talk for the Premier League match day 10, Jim?
Yeah, match day 10, full of surprises. Man City lost 2-0 to Crystal Palace for the upset of the round. Laporte sent off in first half injury time. And with a spare man, Palace were cutthroat on the counter. What was his name? Gallagher, who scored the second goal. Yeah. Palace look like a proper team, man. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Vieira, I think he's really starting to turn things around at Crystal Palace. They only had one defeat they've had one defeat in the last seven matches, and that came away at Liverpool. Got through a really difficult October. They played Man City, Arsenal, Leicester. You know, I think they should be looking for a solid top 10 finish this season. I think it will be a good start to his English Premier League managerial career for Patrick Vieira. Obviously, somebody just banged on the window for you, Jim. There's always somebody banging around in your house, isn't there?
No, it's they're letting off the fireworks, aren't they, man? I always forget how close we are to bonfire. And I just shit myself when that happened.
But so I think Vieira, man, he's looking like a good coach, man. Obviously, he was with the sort of Man City, how can I call it? Like, they've got like loads of different clubs under one umbrella. Like, they're like a conglomerate, aren't they? They've got loads of different clubs everywhere now, like sister clubs in Australia and obviously in the US. And I think he was part of that kind of setup. A little bit like Red Bull do as well. Do you know what I mean? With Jesse Marsh and how he's just been sort of like popped around in the different Red Bull teams. But he seems to have like been cut from the same cloth as sort of Guardiola and stuff. So hopefully, I think it'd be nice to see him at Arsenal one day.
Oh, he interested me a bit there. His management record was quite surprising to me. He's only had two jobs before this, New York City FC and Nice. And I just wanted to ask both of you, is it normal for someone with such little experience to get a job like that in the Premier League?
I would say when you've got history as a player, such as Patrick Vieira has, and he comes with a certain reputation, I think you instantly get a chance at a big job. It's kind of like an easy pass. Do you know what I mean? A fast pass in to get in a good job. So, for example, Frank Lampard, he had to go. Obviously, he had to go to Derby first. He had to sort of like learn his trade at Derby a little bit, and then he got the next big step up, and he got the Chelsea job. Similar with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, sort of not a Man United legend, but certainly a popular player there.
Jim, you don't think he's a legend?
I wouldn't say he's a legend.
He scored the winner in a Champions League final in like the 95th minute. He's not a legend.
He was a super sub. He was a super sub. Anyway, my point is, he went to Molde. He learned his trade with Molde. And I imagine Vieira did that. I think was he at Nice first or was he at New York City FC first? I'm not sure which way, but he's learned his trade almost in his home country. And then he's gone on to the next big thing to like get a big Premier League job. Although Vieira, you know, sort of Crystal Palace was just kind of about right for him. Maybe he's looked at other coaches that have gone into really high profile jobs, like the Chelsea job, like the Man United job, and thought, you know what? I don't think that's for me. I'm going to go somewhere where I can overperform. Do you know what I mean? Under promise and overperform. And then perhaps then I'll step up to the next job. What do you think, Jim?
That's kind of what Steven Gerrard's doing now at Rangers, isn't it? Like, it's a shame. If Liverpool were still in the Roy Hodgson days, I would bank on Gerrard getting that job next season, season after next. But, you know, Jurgen Klopp's absolutely smashing it. And you've seen former Premier League players who've gone straight into big jobs, even on a short-term basis, kind of like Ryan Giggs. He was chosen to steer Man U for a little bit, didn't go that well. Alan Shearer at Newcastle. I'm sure there's one or two more examples I can't think of at the minute, but it seems that, as Bissett just outlined, the recipe is to go to a club, a Derby, a Rangers, a Molde, a Nice, where you can actually, where the stakes aren't quite that high, where the spotlight of the world isn't absolutely blazing the skin off your face from the very first day you're there. So I hope Vieira does really well. I mean, like, for them to be turning over City 2-0, red card or not, that is a big, big achievement. And to be fair, the manager of Brighton, what's his name, is it?
Graham Potter.
Yeah, I can't stop hearing, like, people are just lauding praise on this guy. His team held Liverpool to a 2-2 draw over the weekend. They could have had a winner late on if it weren't for the offside draw. Was it Toussaint who scored the second, the equaliser? Then he could have got a third. They're like the XP dons, aren't they? Like, the amount of chances they created last season versus the amount they actually converted. You were backing them from the very beginning to be like mainstays in the league and possibly do a little bit more than that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And they're hitting home this year. And I think Wolves were a team that have been doing that a lot this year. So we'll see if they can kind of turn their fortunes around based on that data that we were sort of looking up last year. Liverpool, it's a disappointing result for them, really. You wouldn't expect them to drop 2 points. We're just talking about Jurgen Klopp and how good he's been there. And, you know, the reasoning behind Gerrard not getting his chance at being the Liverpool coach is purely down to the fact that he's got that job until he wants to leave, basically, hasn't he? And until he really underperforms. Yeah. And that shows you what a difference can make when you're a high-profile manager. You seem to get a lot more time. And this sort of, you know, the sentiment doesn't turn to disappointment as quickly as it would when you're a guy like Graham Potter who has to perform week in, week out. You know, you have to constantly be over exceeding your expectations when you're not like a high profile manager. So, you know, moving on to the game after that we're going to talk about from the Premier League game week 10, which was Man United Tottenham, where it didn't seem like both managers' jobs were on the line at the time. We thought it just might be Ole, but it turns out that both Ole and Nuno were facing the chop if they didn't win.
On the field matters first. I know we're going to wax lyrical for a long time during this episode, as we often do about Ronaldo. But what do you think of that first goal, man? That is ridiculous. That is ridiculous. One of our episodes is called The Flaccid Van Basten, right? Because it's a certain kind of cross that cuts across the box. You smash it on the volley. Now, it wasn't the looping finish that Van Basten managed in the European finals, but it was absolutely ice cold. Your man's 36 years old, man. He's winning games. He's equalising. He's doing it all over the... I don't even want to talk about it, man. It's ridiculous, man. They got him on a free.
They got him on a free. And you know what? He did it again fucking last night. Do you see his goal from last night? What is wrong with this geezer, man? Like, there's no words to describe, like, how good he is. 36 years old. Like, the technique he has is absolutely unbelievable. And then there was Man United fans that had the absolute audacity to be saying he doesn't work off the ball enough, and, like, you know, he doesn't put the effort in. It's just I can't believe some people. Like, can't believe him, man.
Ronaldo has been smashing it since back in the day when I was beating Conor Flynn at Pro Evo, mate. That's how long he's been about. Since 2004, he's been absolutely smashing it. You can't say enough about him, but... to be honest with you, I disagree slightly on the preconceptions regarding the managers before the game, because you're always going to hear a lot about Ollie because he's the United manager, but the heat was on fucking Nuno, man, because they have had a stinking run, really, since about the same... To be fair, the same time Arsenal started turning it around was when Spurs started going directly downhill. So... what do you attribute that to? I haven't watched that much of him, man. Obviously, Kane's not firing. His son's still playing well. Is like, what are the defence saying? Like, how have Tottenham been generally as a team?
I think the problem has been with Tottenham fans is that they weren't especially excited to see Nuno coming in the first place. At the end of his Wolves tenure, there was the conception that he was playing like too defensive. And, you know, they weren't really playing sort of like fluid, attractive football. And that's not something that Tottenham fans really wanted to hear. So obviously they're like, all right, it's a new manager, new coach. We'll give him a chance. I think they won 5 straight games in all competition to start the league. So that just shows you how far he's dropped in 4 months to go from, you know, winning 5 straight going into the month of September. And now he's not even with them anymore. That showed. And once again, going back to being a high profile coach, and sort of having that, you know, having that respect going into the role, it buys you a few more months, and Ole's been able to buy that time. And then he's obviously got his get out of jail free card, Cristiano Ronaldo, to help him out when he needs it the most. Do you know what I mean? Scoring 2 goals, but it just really shows you how quickly things can spiral. But I think it's the right decision, and I think it's happened because of the availability of Antonio Conte, and obviously he's such a high-profile manager, very reputable. He's won things practically everywhere he's gone. So I think it was the right move to make the change while that guy was available.
You know what? It speaks to your point previously that you made about players with a certain cachet to their name having a little bit more leeway in terms of how long the club will keep him. Mikel Arteta, right? I don't know how he quite became an Arsenal legend, but he seems to have established quite a soft spot with the fans, even when he went to City and it was Pep Guardiola's number 2. So he's got the playing credentials, and then he's got the kind of coaching credentials. Like, he's brushed against greatness, hasn't he? Well, let's be honest. If he wasn't Mikel Arteta, who was Arsenal's captain for 3 or 4 years, he'd have been sat a long time ago. And look at what Arsenal have managed to do in the past few weeks, man. Like, they're on a really good run. They've just beat Leicester 2-0, which is the best result of the season so far. Aaron Ramsdale, the new keeper, his save from James Maddison's free kick was absolutely unreal. Perfect whip and dip on the shot. How Ramsdale managed to get across and tip that onto the bar, then somehow recover for the scramble, I don't know, man. I can't remember the last time we had a proper keeper. Obviously, Leno, he's been serviceable and better than the past iterations. Szczesny, fucking Fabianski, Almunia, terrible trash. They shouldn't even be in the car park at a stadium. Never mind in between the sticks on the pitch, man. Absolutely horrendous. Ramsdale just pulled off a world-beating save. So
where'd you compare that with Banksy, Gordon Banks?
Ah, straight back to you. Love England so much. 1970 England reference.
No, I think, come on, you can't really, you got to put Banks ahead of that. Yeah, you know, it's just the stage around. Jesus, Pele's heading it down at you. That's like if he saved Ronaldo's header from point blank, then I'd put it up there.
I bet Peter Schmeichel's made a few good ones in his day as well. He's made a few fantastic ones. We should get a real top. We should do a top five greatest saves of all time next week.
Yeah, we'll do it. But we're gonna have the Man U fan on next week, haven't we? So he might be a little bit biased. Maybe he's a Barthez fan. I don't know.
I can't see that it, really. Yeah.
Just a quick one for the lads as well. Villa getting smashed 4-1 by West Ham. Didn't really look into the game too much, but I thought I'd mention that for Pizzy and Young Jack. I don't even know who scored in that game, to be fair.
Yeah, I was watching that. I had a few hair of the dogs in the local pub, and that was on. It was about midday. I think that it was 1-1 going into the second half. And then Villa had a man sent off. And then Tara Mings come on, and then all of a sudden West Ham scored 3 goals. So that shows you how good Tyrone Mings has been for that team, although there was 10 men. But I'm growing exactly like my dad. My dad just hates Tyrone Mings, and I think I'm just starting to like to turn into my dad every day. He hates Tyrone Mings. And Fred.
You've been hating Fred for years, man. Well, do you want to move on to the Champions League?
Yeah, let's rattle off that, and then we've got the 5 things you might have missed, and then straight into the combat sport stuff.
Oh, sweet. Well, we'll carry on with Man U then, to be fair. But they were held 2-2 away at Atlanta. Criminal goalkeeping from David De Gea for Atlanta's first goal after just 12 minutes. Pogba then dribbled into his own box, lost the ball, and nearly gave away another. This is literally 2 or 3 minutes after, and this is why he pisses me off. He's such a quality player. His long-range passing is outrageous, but these lapses in concentration, casualness, like Atlanta, they're an intense team, man. You can't be fucking about when they're going to be swarming you all around the box, and he just, you know, irresponsible midfield player there. But credit where it's due, United's movement, interplay, and speed were unreal for their equaliser. Fernandes and Ronaldo with the Portuguese hookup, 10 out of 10 for chemistry. But early in the second half, they were undone by a simple ball over the top. Zapata through, tidy finish. The best and worst of United in a 10-minute span, really. A lack of clear chances until a minute gone in injury time. They were wrangling it around the edge of Atlanta's area. Ronnie's breaking across. A defender got a touch. Greenwood kept it alive. Then the olive-skinned god himself smashed it into the bottom corner. Ridiculous player.
I know we're always like literally sucking Ronaldo off. So I want to try and steer away from that. And we'll talk about how bad Pogba is for United at the minute.
Come on, love it.
I'm getting like Graham Souness and Paul Scholes. Like they hate him as well. But no, it is frustrating though, because he can be absolutely unbelievable for France. Like sometimes you see him and he looks like the best player in the world. And like, I don't know. I'll ask one to you, Flynn. What do you think might be the difference between performing for your country at like such an elite level and then like looking like an average baller, like when you're playing for your club side, making sort of concentration mistakes and, you know, real sort of like silly, stupid mistakes that a professional footballer shouldn't be making? What do you think could cause that, man?
Maybe he's just one of these people who thrives on pressure. They're a rare breed usually, but I would imagine the pressure's 10 times higher when you're playing for the country rather than the club. Some people crumble under it. Some people completely thrive in it and do well. Maybe he's just one of those sorts of guys.
Yeah, you could argue that. You could argue that there's a lot more pressure playing for France because their supporters expect a lot. You know, they're really, really highly demand performances whenever they play. Obviously, they've had a lot of problems in the past with squads and stuff like that, haven't they, where players refuse to play for managers and things like that. I think that was a few years ago, wasn't it? And they had a bit of a dip in form where they didn't make a Euros or a World Cup, was it? But same again with United. Obviously, they're both high-profile jobs, and there was a lot of talk about Pogba, whether he was going to stay after he returned from Juventus, you know, and he hasn't really recaptured any kind of form that he's had for France or Juventus or even, you know, for the short period he was at United when he was first there. But at the moment, I don't know what it is, man. He just doesn't look like he wants to be there. It's the easiest way to say it, really.
If you're a player with that kind of immense talent, it's kind of like Tyson Fury, man. Like, he's obviously the
best heavyweight in the world. But if you watch him against someone average, he looks a bit shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't look like the guy that beat Deontay Wilder over 11 rounds last time out. I think there's, as Flynn's alluded to, there's a stimulus problem there. Obviously, Pogba's lack of threats or his lack of urgency doesn't translate to what's actually happening, because Ollie's under a lot of pressure. Man U are under a lot of pressure to do something in the league, in the Champions League, to get any kind of silverware going. Look, he's an integral part of that team. Whether we like him or not, he's one of the main guys. Never mind someone like Donny van der Beek, who's absolutely world-class and doesn't even get like half an hour a game. He's keeping those kind of players out. Whether that's to do with name value or not, he's in that seat. And he's kind of shirking the responsibility to, you know, take the team by the scruff of the neck and drag him through games. It's almost as if you don't want it, like you said, Bissett.
He works better in a three-man midfield where he's the sort of, where he's the eight and he's got two defensive players behind him, like Kante for the France team. And if you've got another one in there, I don't know, I can't think of the other defensive midfielder, maybe that Rabiot, Adrien Rabiot. So I think he's at Juve now. He was at Juve anyway. So having two defensive-minded players behind him for that extra protection, that makes him look better. And I think he works better in that role. Whereas I think a lot of the times when he comes on for United, he plays as a six, as a defensive mid, and then he has someone like Bruno Fernandes ahead of him. So, Jim, you watched the highlights of the Bayern game. I did not. I did see the result, and I saw it was another Lewandowski absolute masterclass. I'm sure he's going to win a Ballon d'Or this year. Has to.
Well, listen, I don't want to make it sound simplistic, but Bayern were just Bayern. They smashed Benfica 5-2 at home. Kingsley Coman terrorised the defence. Another Lewandowski hat-trick and an assist. And he had a penalty saved as well. Gnabry was playing FIFA Street with his goal. That was just fucking unreal. Sané's wasn't bad either. Mad high kung fu kick volley straight into the bottom corner. It was a relentless assault on the Benfica goal from start to finish. And it speaks to Bayern's dominance that I didn't even blink when I saw the scoreline. Any team on any given day is liable to get turned over like that when they go to the Allianz. It was ridiculous, man. It was almost hard to watch on Benfica's part, to be honest.
That's a crazy point, man. The fact that when you see that Bayern have beat somebody 5-2, it's just like, you don't blink an eye. You don't. It's just business as usual, isn't it? Even a team like Benfica, who you would put them up there as, like, not a European powerhouse, but certainly a team that's been a mainstay in European football for a significant period of time, and you expect to be competitive. For them to just smash teams up like 5-2, it's incredible, man. And they've got players like, I say, like Kingsley Coman, who's been around a little bit, been at different teams in Europe. Serge Gnabry, who's obviously at Arsenal, they let him go and he's gone on to be, you know, turned into be what he's one of probably, you know, one of the stronger players in Europe. Also the other guy, Leroy Sané, was at Man City. You know what I mean? A fantastic footballer, and they've taken him in after Man City didn't want him. And then he's just playing out of his skin. It's just, they just continue to be dominant, don't they, Bayern, like year in, year out.
The difference between Lewandowski at the Euros and in Bayern is outrageous, man. I think his second or third goal, first touch with his left foot, it was perfect, man. Just took the defender out of the game, then chipped the keeper with the outside of his right, casual as you like. He didn't even watch it go across the line. He just knew it was in. This is a team and a player that are in full swagger mode right now. Look, to be honest with you, I think they're going to be the team this year. I know they're always there or thereabouts, semis and finals, man, but I think they might go all the way this year.
That's a fair comment. Yeah, obviously you've got Man City, they're definitely going to challenge again, you would assume. PSG, I'm not so sure, really don't know. They haven't been half of what we expected them to be in the Champions League since Messi's gone there. Obviously he's been, you know, a sort of a bit part player, really. He hasn't played every game, and then he hasn't really performed in many games. So it'll be interesting to see how he progresses the further they go on in the Champions League stages. Obviously, they need to make the knockouts, or else that'll be the end of their current coach, won't it? So that's basically his minimum requirements, isn't it? As PSG is to probably get to a semi final of the Champions League.
But the thing is, not everyone's flying at this early stage. Like, look at Chelsea and Barcelona. They beat Malmo and Dinamo Kiev 1-0 respectively. Like, that's not like you'd expect the like 3, 4, 5s maybe, but it's a steady win for Chelsea, who have looked solid in the league. But that is actually a great result for Barcelona post-Koeman and in the 6-month shitstorm they've been in. Like, any win on any high level is great for them. Likewise for Juventus, they're 9th in Serie A, but managed to beat Zenit 4-2, Dybala with a double. Great goal from the eternal engine of Chiesa, who we marvelled at in the Euros in the summer. Still, they must be missing Ronnie like mad.
Yeah, and as we intonated last week, got that sort of post-superstar hangover. And Barcelona on they were supposedly on the verge of luring Xavi from, is it Al Sadd, the Qatar, are they Qatari-based team that he's won about 4 trophies within 12 months or something? Anyway, he's been incredible there, but apparently he's been told he cannot leave under any circumstances.
It's next season it's happening, isn't it? That's what I was reading before. Start of next season, finish out his contract for this year, and then just I think Barca will either buy him out or he'll just quit and then go to Barca himself, innit?
And Flynn, you'd have to assume that's going to go down with the locals, isn't it? A player of that magnitude coming back and coaching him.
Absolutely. And I think he's from a town just down the road as well. So he's a home boy. Yeah, I think that's going to be huge with people over here. So what's the situation with with him in Qatar? He's not allowed to leave? What kind of contract is that?
Yeah, it's
a pretty legal one.
Yeah, pretty legal. I don't know. It seemed like the owners came out and said like, "Nah, he ain't going anywhere. Just shit." Do you know what I mean? Just kind of like, he's going to be respectful and stay with us, but actually, you know, they've probably got like eyes on his house. Do you know what I mean? Snipers when he leaves his door, just in case he's sneaking off.
Oh, they give about human rights and legality. They'll probably just leave an empty suitcase outside his front door and just be like, "Remember what happened to that last geezer? You better watch your step, Xavi. I don't give a fuck where you were born, mate."
I got another question there for you, Bissett, about him. You were saying last week that the owner of the Barca doesn't like him. What's the situation there?
Doesn't like who, Xavi?
Yeah.
Did I say that?
Oh, I thought you said that. The owner of Barcelona doesn't like Xavi, or was I reading this somewhere?
No, you might have been reading that somewhere. I don't remember saying
maybe
that.
I read that
sounds
somewhere.
Pretty interesting, though. I wonder where the friction's been caused there.
I'll look into
definitely
it.
Definitely shagged his wife, innit? I feel like whenever there's friction with footballers and owners or like coaches, it's like somebody's got who shags whose wife, man? Come on. Let's get it out in the open.
They're all doing it to each other's wives anyway, man. That's another top 5 thing we could do, other than the best goalkeeping saves. So we can get Wayne Bridge in there. Who's the one who played Icardi? Yeah, he stole his fucking mate's missus, didn't he?
Well, wait, hold on. Wayne Bridge was on the receiving end of it. It's harsh to name him. It was Terry, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was the Wayne Bridge affair. You can't. The Wayne Bridge scandal.
The Weybridge scandal, even though it was his missus that was shagging John Terry. Yeah. And then you got Ryan Giggs, classic, shagging his brother's missus. Rodri, yeah. His sister-in-law, which is...
I told you, I listened to that podcast with Rodri Giggs before, and to be honest with you, he sounded like a bit of a prick, so I lost a bit of sympathy for him. He did, I got to be honest with you. I know it's screwing one lot, but he did sound like a prick.
Maybe it turned him into a prick.
yeah, maybe. But apparently he was playing for like Scunthorpe or something. And he went into the manager's house, he was invited to dinner. And then he was just going upstairs, like rifling through people's drawers and that, and just snatching what he could. Like, proper wild. Like, what the fuck are you on about, man?
He does look a bit of a wild one, doesn't he? Like, I don't know.
Nightmare guy, man.
He's got that look in his eyes, man. He's a bit of a weird looking geezer. But just so we don't, you know, veer onto other paths, we'll just have a quick notable mention on Ajax. Absolutely donned off Borussia Dortmund, a Champions League semi-finalist, remember, from last year. And they beat him in 2 weeks, back-to-back victories, 4-0 and 3-1, playing some sublime football with players you never heard of, or barely heard of at least. They always sell their best years every single year to teams like Man United for extortionate fees, and then they never play them, Donny van de Beek, or buy back, you know, some players on the cheap a few years later, and then they're back scoring goals in the Champions League, just as they did last night, David Klaassen, or they sign failed Premier League footballers, Sebastian Haller, who was at West Ham, who has now scored 7 goals and 2 assists in 4 Champions League games this season, absolutely love what they're doing there, mugging teams off. I think we should make their our like the ball chat team. Do you know what I mean? That we just like follow and like, you know, follow every single week and just big up every week.
I'm happy with that, to be fair. And also they had the Bob Marley kit, didn't they? The third kit, the three little birds one. And they're also from Amsterdam, like bud smoking capital of Europe. Like, what's not to love, man? What is not to love about Ajax?
Yeah, that's what I'm gonna say, man. Like, you've said that before, so they're definitely gonna be the ball chat sports team, the footy team. All right. So, because we've got a little bit of a different format this week, we'll roll into the five things you might have missed, and then we're straight into the combat sports, which is going to be an interesting one. So, lots of stuff to chat about with that, with UFC 268, which was last weekend.
Yeah.
Oh no,
67. Yeah, 67 last week, weekend.
268 coming up. Yeah. So back to back, absolutely fantastic sporting events in the combat sports. So number one, Clarissa Shields, from the five things you might have missed. She was defeated in her only second MMA bout. So this is the PFL, which I'm going to get you to explain, Jim, after you explain what happened with her.
Okay, so it was a tough one for the quotes. And for those wondering what the anachronism means, it's the greatest woman of all time. It doesn't roll off the tongue, does it? But she consistently insists on using it. So I'm gonna go with her out of respect. But she looked like she progressed the takedown defense, but just like in her MMA debut, she did struggle badly from the bottom, trying to punch upward when she got frustrated. But fair play to her, man. She's taken herself out of her comfort zone. She's risked her big reputation with this foray into the cage. She's a proper fighter. I've got no doubt she'll be back. But I think this is a demonstration that her skills lie within the ropes rather than the cage. She's obviously an undisputed light middleweight champion. I think she got pretty close as a middleweight as well. Undefeated, two-time gold medalist in the ring. But, you know, she's putting herself out there. Not a lot of fighters. Actually, I don't think any fighter would put herself in such an uncomfortable position as she did in going back into the cage for a second time after she scraped through her first bout.
And this PFL, it's an organization within the MMA umbrella, essentially, the sport of MMA. So it's similar to UFC. But was I right in understanding that one of the votes goes to fans that are watching the fight? Or was that just a statistic that they put up there?
Well, I'm not sure, but they've definitely got a different scoring system. They go on a points basis from round to round. So I think it's points scored in the third round mean more than in the first.
Mad. Interesting. Well, like,
they've definitely got a different stance on it. But was that one championship? No, one championship score like that. Yeah. And they have PFL have like a league system. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
they've got like a Premier League
promotion
system.
Relegation. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. So that does go into the scoring a little bit, but not as heavily as it does in one in terms of round by round. Yeah. But obviously, Clarissa Shields wasn't going to go into the UFC, was she? Because you would have got her fucking head kicked off her shoulders straight away. So it's one of them. But I've got all respect for it. You can lose and come back in MMA. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't harm her commercial appeal as a boxer. She's still got that Savannah Marshall fight waiting on Sky Sports. So that's coming, man. No worries about that.
So she's still got a long way to go to beat the true quote, Mother Teresa or Florence Nightingale. Or, you know what I mean? True quotes of the time.
Yeah.
Well, Mother Teresa's wrestling skills.
Yeah, she's up there, Florence, man. She's Florencing it out.
I have a question there for you, Jim, about Ambisit as well. You mentioned that there's possibly these fights in the PFL are judged by the fans, or the fans count as one judge. Do you think that would be a good idea if it was ever to be implemented?
Trolls would fuck it up. So I'd like to think that everyone would have their notebooks out scoring rounds and taking studious notes. But let's be honest, half the people online are just waiting to fuck shit up. So nah, you can't open it to those people at all, man.
You know the people that would start getting involved in it? The same people that when, I think it was like David Attenborough needed to name his boat or something to go on an expedition around the world, and they called it Boaty McBoatface. That's the sort of shit that would happen. These are sort of people that would get involved in it. And they're just like, they just troll it. He's right, man. He's exactly right. People cannot be trusted in it. Mm-hmm. All right, number two, New England Revolution broke the all-time MLS record for most points scored in a single season. Head coach Bruce Arena, who is a bit of an MLS specialist, even if he was dog shit with the US national team, and even had the audacity to write a book entitled What's Wrong with US Soccer after his tenure, has previously won 5 MLS Cups when he took over as New England coach in May 2019, when they were scrapping at the bottom of the table. He'll be hoping to cap off winning the Supporters Shield with an MLS Cup when the playoffs start later this month. So a pretty remarkable achievement, considering the MLS hasn't been around all that long, but still for a few decades now, at least. And he's got the highest points total of all time. So Seattle Sounders were a team that have basically dominated the whole thing for a long time. 13 consecutive playoffs or something like that. Put respect on Bruce Arena's name, even though he was terrible, terrible with the US and failed to make the World Cup in 2018.
Are they the new Preston North End? Because Preston North End have an all-time mainstay position in pub quizzes up and down the country as the first ever team to win a national league. Now, I can't imagine how bad the standard of football was back in the day. But is this kind of the area we're treading in?
I'm not sure. Fella? Yeah, well, comparatively. It's kind of like when Liverpool... Did Liverpool, was it when they won the league, they got to 100 and something points, something like that? It's yeah, kind of like a diluted version of that. Mix a bit of, like, if you're gonna do yourself a double rum, like water it down a little bit, and then that's what you've got with this.
I never water down my rums, mate, so that I can't take this stat seriously. Some of the no, but the thing is, look, a league has to start somewhere. Competition, stats, all that stuff. It has to have an embryonic stage. So obviously, I'm gonna take the piss out of it because it's US soccer ball, but at the same time, they have to create their own standards. And we've seen various players go over there. Yeah, all right, they might be at the end of their careers, but they're still top quality players, man. And some people have gone before that. So as long as the commercial side of it, which it's America, and it obviously that's still gonna grow. And with like the Man City franchises, the Red Bull franchises, the next 10, 20 years, I think it'll be a lot slower in growing because of the amount of mainstream sports they've got over there.
Like it
will take a long time, but I still think that commerciality and the infrastructure, it's going to carry on growing. But obviously for now, old Brucey boy needs to settle down, man. Needs to win a few Champions Leagues before I put respect on his name, mate.
Number three, basketballer Enes Kanter has called out China and Xi Jinping, which is dangerous to do, calling him a brutal dictator in a series of Twitter videos, pressuring them to free the Uyghur Muslims, if I'm pronouncing that right, that are in the apparent slave labor camps. He focuses his attention on the sportswear brand Nike for producing their trainers in these camps and invited Nike's president, Phil Knight, and NBA legends Michael Jordan and LeBron James to visit the factories. Notice that I'd said apparent slave labor camps because I do not want to upset my wife.
Oh, shit. All right. Flynn, what do you think about this, man? What do you think? Just go from the top, just based on that, what do you think about this?
What do I think of the alleged slave labor camps?
No. We all pretty much think the same thing about that. Let's just hope that Jess ain't listening. But what do you think? What do you think about a pro basketball player, a wealthy man, someone who's most likely lifted himself up out of unfavorable circumstances through his sport to jeopardize his position like this? What do you think about that?
I think it's brave. I think it's a really brave thing for someone to do. And I remember reading about, I don't know, there was a lot of criticism towards the NBA about 6 months to a year ago. I can't remember which basketballers or which teams specifically, but they were accused of selling out to China, whatever that means, or choosing to talk certain ways in interviews, not to mention what's happening to the Uyghur people. I've got a lot of respect for someone who's not afraid to stand up and say, look, I don't really care about the money. This, by many accounts, this is a human rights atrocity, by many accounts. So, yeah, you've got to give someone like that respect to stand up and talk about it.
And before I get on my high horse, right, I want to say that none of us are free from blame, because I wear Nike trainers. I use a fucking smartphone. I've got labels and things in my house, and I'm watching this now on a MacBook Air. Do you know what I mean? So none of us are free of guilt. All of us are part of the commercial machine, but I've got less skin in the game than someone like him who's earning tens of millions of dollars a year, probably supporting his whole extended family through his sport. And it's not as if he's done this on a whim. Cancer's got form for this. ESPN made a documentary about him in 2019 after he voiced support for a Muslim cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who, according to Turkish President Erdogan, attempted a political coup. The Turkish government then tried to have Kanter extradited home, but the Yanks told him to fuck off. So this is something he's part of, man. He grew up in Turkey, in Istanbul. He's politically active. He's politically aware. And also just happens to be a darn athlete. And he's playing to his strengths. So the more I read about him, the more I like this guy, man. Fair play to him.
Yeah, this is in the realms of the deep ball chat. But as you say, like, has to be respected, man. Fair play to him for standing for what he believes in and what many people believe is a human rights atrocity, for sure. All right, number four, Bristol Rovers manager Joey Barton has, talking about atrocities, has apologised for his comments comparing his side's defending to the Holocaust after a 3-1 defeat to Newport last Saturday. He said, someone gets in for a game, does well, but then has a Holocaust, a nightmare, an absolute disaster. Agreed, Joey, the Holocaust was an understatement, a nightmare, but I don't think it's comparable to League Two footy, so I reckon he should probably avoid referencing this. There have been calls for him to be sacked because of his comments. However, I think he should be sacked just because he's genuinely a horrible guy and he puts on French accents when he's in France.
Oh, you bastard. I was just about to say, what do you think's more offensive? These comments or his accent when he was at Marseille? Fuck. We go to the ball. You see this not to play. It's like, mate, what the fuck are you doing? You were punching lads in the sternum 2 weeks ago when you were playing for Newcastle. Do you remember that tackle? Was it a tackle back in the day? We absolutely forearm smashed someone in the face. Do you remember that shit?
No, he's probably done him on, he was doing him on the regs, man. He was a horrible, dirty player.
When he was playing for City, he like knocked someone senseless, man, just on a random one. Some council estate kid gone awry, man. Fuck him. He shouldn't have been given 50 grand a week. Absolute liability, man.
What do you reckon, Flynn? If one of your co-workers said, oh, Flynn, he gets in from work, he does well, but then he just has a Holocaust.
they wouldn't be wrong. Look, I don't know anything about this Joey Barton, but from just hearing you two talking about him, was he putting on a French accent?
Look on YouTube, it's hilarious. And then search for what's his name? Was it Hoddle? Glenn Hoddle's Dutch accent. Is it Hoddle? Is he the one that did the Dutch accent? There's a manager that did it as well.
Yeah. Is it Rotterdam when I think Hoddle?
Yeah,
was it Steve Steve McLaren.
McLaren.
Yeah. That's it. Oh, fucking hell. Oh, fuck them all, man. I'm going to stop watching football.
Right, number five. Sportico has released a list of the highest paid athletes of all time. And because we didn't really have time for the quiz today, kind of still figuring the format out for the three-man ball chat. I'm going to sneak a quiz question in there. So this is also... So you're going to name how many you two can name in the top 10. So this is also taking into consideration adjustment for inflation earnings. So there's going to be a few oldies in there. So I'll give you as long as you want. Try and get as many as you can. Let's say 60 seconds.
So I'll let you go first, Flynn. Go on.
So I'm thinking maybe it's someone with a lot of endorsement deals. The way Dr. Dre was the highest paid musician because he brought out Beats. Conor McGregor was the biggest this year, but all time, is that going to cut it? I don't know.
This isn't involving that. I think this might be salary, like earnings. Oh, okay. Competition salary and salary sport. Earnings, I believe so, yeah.
Iron Mike Tyson, is he up there?
No, he's not.
Wow. Shocking. I'm genuinely shocked by that, you know. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. there's only one boxer. And he is...
on for you.
It's got to be Floyd, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
Money Floyd. Mayweather. There you go. There's one.
Yeah. All right. I'll have a guess. Michael Jordan's got to be up there.
Yeah, he's number one. 2.62 Woo! Billion.
Wow.
There's another basketballer.
LeBron James.
Yeah. Three out of 10.
Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yes. Ding, Woo! Ding. There's one more footballer.
Messi.
Ding, ding. So you got five left.
Tiger Woods.
Ding, ding.
Oh, no.
Yeah. There's two more golfers. These are going to be the hardest two. So I would avoid them. There is...
Jack Nicklaus.
Yeah, ding, ding.
Wow.
What's three up? Left. It's the three return left. Of the Mac. One more still alive, like
there's
two
one pair. More golfer. There's a Formula One player. Schumacher. There you go. Ding, ding. Right, there's one more tennis player and a golfer.
Federer.
Yeah, Federer. And then who's the last golfer?
Adam Scott.
Nope.
The only name.
We've got to get this one, man. Not like Vijay Singh, is it? Not Rory McDonald. Not Rory McDonald. That's an MMA fighter. Rory McIlroy.
Nope.
Is it Arnold Palmer?
Absolutely smashed it, boys. That was like, mate, probably like listen, 2 minutes, but that was fantastic.
My neighbors have just watched me throw mad shape through the bay windows for the past 2-3 minutes, man. No wonder they don't stop and say hello when I'm walking the dog. I look a fucking nutcase.
Now, that was a good way to end the five things you might have missed then, boys. I was really impressed with that. I didn't think you were going to get all them so quickly. So very, very good. So let's crack on with this combat sports stuff, because it's going to be a good old chat. UFC 267. You watched the full thing. Jim, you take us away with it.
The only reason I could watch the whole thing is because it was on at normal times in Abu Dhabi, which, you know, I don't want to say the upside of human rights violations, but I was feeling pretty beneficial on Saturday based on that. So there are a few shocking results on the night, but the most predictable was Khamzat Chimaev treating Li Jiangli like a teddy bear, man. He got hold of him, carried... It was madness, man. He got hold of him, carried him over to the side of the cage where Dana White was sitting, held him up there while he shouted at the boss, slammed him down, choked him out. Jing Liang defended as best as he could, but he couldn't delay the inevitable for long. That's 10 finishes in 10 wins for the Chechen Wolf, which is a sick nickname. He's still only 27, and with that style, his size, and his appetite for combat, he'll be tough to beat. Did you guys catch any of this?
Yeah, I watched the whole card. It was awesome. I read afterwards he's only been struck once in his 4 fights. Is that true?
Crazy. Amazing. One of the guys he fought, I think he was in his second or third fight, he fought in a 10-day span, just beat 2 people in the first round within 10 days, and he just cleaned him out of a punch. So this guy's got a well-rounded game. It's just that it's a higher percentage style, dragging people to the ground and choking them out. And let's be honest, he looks like a serial killer with that scar across his face.
He does.
I mean...
Oh, pure. And it was what he did was like one of the most audacious things I've ever seen in sports. He like literally just picked the geezer up, went over to Dana and was like, apparently he said, got off your phone, because Dana was on his phone, like not watching. Like this, and it was like eight seconds in the fight, just picked this geezer up and like went over to Dana and like, are you watching? And then slammed him on the ground and was like, and apparently he was like, oh, I'm going to choke him out now. Like, honestly, that is like, that is serial killer, psycho levels, man. Eyeballs on him.
Listen, with this influx of Eastern fighters into the UFC, and we're talking Dagestanis, Chechens, Russians, we're talking the ends, man. We're talking tracksuits and shoes, man. Do you know what I mean? We're talking radiation. Do you know what I mean? Geiger counters up in here. Yeah, trust me, this is a style that's proven so, it's almost indefensible. Another example of that was Islam Makhachev, who made equally short work of Dan Hooker, which this was supposed to be not a 50-50, but a 60-40 at least. This was a surprise. And similar to Khamzat, Islam has that grappling style nailed down. When you got people like Khabib talking about you, like you're the next guy, then you must be something special, man. Hooker managed to keep the fight standing for about 40 seconds. The moment he threw a leg kick, Islam countered with a right hook and transitioned into a takedown immediately. He executed that with frightening speed. Hooker scooted to the cage, which is like what he should do. You see Conor McGregor doing that when he was fighting Khabib, when he fought Poirier. He tried to scoot there, but Islam latched onto him, established wrist control, wriggled out of half guard, worked his way around to a nasty Kimura position. He put the finishing touches on by stepping over Hooker's head for the extra bit of torque. And I have no doubt he would have ripped his shoulder to pieces if the ref didn't step in. Absolutely astounding performance.
That was this was the fight that I was most hyped about last week. Me and Bissett were talking about it. Like, I'm a huge fan, I'm sure like you, Jim, of the Dagestani wrestlers. They're just incredible to watch. But I also found quite a lot to like about Dan Hooker. He took the fight on with barely any notice straight after beating Nasrat Haqparast on September 25th. So that's like less than a month ago. Yeah. There's no real training camp you can do in that. There's nothing. I respected the confidence he was showing the whole time. I don't know if you caught many of the interviews, but he seemed happy-go-lucky. He didn't seem that phased. But like you said, he got caught in a brutal Kimura. I agree with you. I don't think he was going to tap. I think he was ready to let that arm break before tapping. Huge respect to him, even though, yeah, it's pretty reckless to be doing something like that. it's just a job at the end of the day. You don't have to let your arm break, but still, you got to respect the man for that. Yeah. Oh, I don't know if you caught this. So obviously, Habib was in Islam's corner. I recently saw some comments online. So he was shouting commands to him in Russian. Apparently, some people online have translated them. And apparently, everything Habib ordered, Islam immediately did. It was like he had a PlayStation controller controlling him or so.
The thing is, they're in the training room together all the time as well. So if Khabib's got into that habit of saying, do this, do that, do this, do that, and he's responding like that, and he's able to hear Khabib in the middle of the fight, that is the perfect fighter-trainer relationship you want right there. There was a lot of talk about Islam before this. Why is he in the top five when he hadn't really fought no one? No one can say Dan Hooker is not a fearsome opponent. You look at what he put Dustin Poirier through, who just made mincemeat out of Conor McGregor two times in a row. Everyone loves Conor McGregor. He's this big star. Poirier just buoyed him up. And Dan Hooker went life and death with him, man. Do you know what I mean? So, and Paul Felder as well, who's now on the UFC commentary team. But he was absolutely ridiculous, man. Contender for his whole tenure in the UFC. And I didn't expect it to be that one-sided. But the co-main event for the evening was not so one-sided. Corey Sanhagen, Peter Yan, they exchanged high-level strikes for five rounds, with Yan edging away as the fight progressed. Both fighters constantly switching stances, fighting for hand positions, throwing unorthodox, unexpected attacks off the rhythm. This was two impeccably elite, outrageously talented, tuned-in fighters using every trick at their disposal. The main difference between them was that Yan threw more potential knockout blows, whereas Sanhagen, despite the odd flying knee attempt, he seemed more content to pick away and stay at range. Yan's spinning back fist hook combination was devastating. And we were talking the other week about kung fu strikes, or you guys were, I hope you listened to you guys do it. But it was some kung fu Wu-Tang Shaolin Temple type shit, man. And I don't know where he gets that from. It's like you expect Russian fighters to be stoic and really technical. There's this flair, it's unorthodox, this inventiveness about what he does when he's in the cage. He threw that combination consistently in the fight. He dropped Sanhagen with it in the third. Rounds four and five saw Sanhagen leaning more heavily over that front foot and slowing down. Yan pulled away over the final stretch and won 4-1 on all three scorecards. He's the new interim bantamweight champion, and Aljamain Sterling must be shitting himself.
Absolutely bricking it, man, because like I love this guy. I absolutely love Yan. I love watching him fight. And there don't seem to be any man in that bantamweight division that can match his combination of technique, defense, stamina, durability. I think he's the best current boxer I have seen in the UFC. The only one that comes to mind from fighting this year was Rob Font, who I thought boxed really well, but who beat Cody Garbrandt early this year. But I honestly think if you put Petr Yan in a boxing ring, he would beat 85 to 90% of the fighters in his weight category, because he boxes beautifully, man. He's so, so good in that regard of the fight. And I think the progression of Yan in this fight was incredible. You could see him figuring Sanhagen out after a lightning first round from Sanhagen, where he was just like, he's so mobile, isn't he? And he's so difficult to sort of pin down initially. And I think, you know, as soon as Yan started to acclimatize to his movement and making him miss and being aware of his kind of like, you know, he switches from like orthodox to southpaw, like lightning, doesn't he? From sort of like from one moment to another. Like, and the way he does it is incredible. And Yan just matched that and just wore him down, just stuck to what he knew. And he had that in that third round, that incredible sort of back fist. And then it was just a masterclass for me. I can't perceive any trouble or much trouble from TJ Dillashaw or Aljamain Sterling, who are the only two guys that seem to be left in that division to beat him.
You know what? I think the Petr Yan, TJ Dillashaw fight, that would be sick, man. I'm not sure he'd run through TJ, you know, because all that EPO drug cheat stuff aside, he's a ruthless bastard, man. And I think the only thing that's going to count against him there is his age. I think TJ is like 33, 34, just injured his knee, just injured his shoulder, coming off a 2-year layoff. I think that's all going to count against him. Because Yan's like a predator, and he's only like 27, 28 years old, something like that.
I think he'll make absolute mincemeat of Aljamain Sterling again, because that's exactly what he did in the first fight. And the only reason he got fucked out of it is because he threw a knee when he had his hand down on the mat. Yeah. And then Aljamain Sterling won his Academy Award, which is good. Like, I'm not saying it's easy to get kneed in the face by Petr Yan, but I'm just saying, like, made a bit much of it.
Yeah, milked.
Yeah, yeah. You can have, oftentimes when we talk about combat sports, it's a lot of like dark and dreary shit. It's always like drug cheats, and I'm always complaining, should we say. But this, in the main event, was a genuinely feel-good moment. Glover Teixeira became the light heavyweight champion, age 42, with a second-round submission over Jan Blachowicz. It's a strange thing to say, but John Jones leaving the division was the best thing that could have happened. He was so dominant for such a long time. Neither of these guys would have had a look in if he was still around. Jones already dominated Glover all the way back in 2014, and Glover's been chipping away ever since. 14 fights, 10 wins. Suffered a bad knockout loss to Alexander Gustafsson in 2017, which is an actual highlight reel knockout, if you ever care to look it up. That could have been the end for him, but he stuck with it. Jan then won the vacant belt by knocking out Dominic Reyes. He defended it against Israel Adesanya, and he wasn't favored to win that fight. Adesanya's an elite-level striker, but he managed to utilize his wrestling and his size to his advantage, and he took Adesanya's undefeated record. Then you get these two veteran warriors coming together in a title fight that would have seemed impossible only two or three years ago. And it turned out to be a simple night's work for Glover. He took Jan down in the first, didn't let him up. In the second, he hurt him with a left hook, took him down again, cut through his guard like it wasn't even there, and scored a rear naked choke for the win. I thought Jan was going to blast him out of there, but my fine form of making incorrect picks goes on. Big up Glover, second oldest champion in UFC history behind the great Randy Couture. Praise be.
I got to agree with you. Yeah, huge respect to Glover after this one. Look, I'm no expert in martial arts, but it seemed like he had some insane BJJ skills. Correct me if I'm wrong. But and it seemed his skills were just way too much for Jan to do anything about it. Though I did notice at one point, I can't remember which round, but Jan was down on his back on the floor. Glover was on top of him. Jan defended quite well by wrapping his legs around the waist, which seemed to lock out Glover's legs. But at some point he decided to give up his back, I noticed, and that was it. The choke was landed and it was all over. But I've got a bit of a question there for you, Jim. It seemed like a really big night for grapplers. We had three submissions, no knockouts, and I wanted to get your take on striking versus grappling. I think you alluded to it a little bit earlier. Are we one day just going to see a roster filled with wrestlers and grapplers? What do you think?
Well, the mid to late 90s was the heyday for grapplers in the UFC. And it's in the name, isn't it? Mixed martial arts. You can't lean too heavily towards one thing because other people are going to find the antithesis, the hole on the other side. What makes Khamzat so frightening is that he seems to have legit stand-up skills. Now, Khabib, you might not call his stand-up elite, but he managed to drop Conor McGregor with an overhand right, and he's supposed to be the best striker of all time, blah, blah, blah. So what these wrestlers present with their threat of a takedown, it makes their opponents behave differently. Like Jorge Masvidal getting knocked out by Kamaru Usman. Who the fuck saw that coming? But Masvidal said after the fact, he's like, I was ready to wrestle for 25 minutes. And he had half an eye on the takedown, half ready to defend all the time. So when a massive full-blooded shot comes your way, you're only half defending it. And that's what it takes when you've got 4-ounce gloves on. You need the balance. Joe Rogan said, like, infinite amount of times that he thinks wrestling is the most essential component that you can build around for an MMA fighter. So, yeah, absolutely. I agree that that kind of style breeds more success than most of the others. But I also think you need to have some kind of competency in the stand-up.
UFC 268. So we know the big fights that are happening there, Jim. Which one are you looking forward to the most?
Oh, that's a tough question, you know. I really feel like you put me on the spot. okay, this is going to sound like a real fucking hipster pick, but I'm going to go with Rose Namajunas and Zhang Weili because, okay, I've got extra respect for the women in the UFC because it's the first time I've seen women compete in any sport where I've thought, there is absolutely no difference in quality between what they're doing and what the men are doing. Now, I don't know if that's just a perception thing on my part. I think women throw better kicks in general. I think there's just like a kind of dexterity and elegance to the way they move, that there's an added quality to what they do in the cage, which isn't there in boxing and in kickboxing, strangely enough. I've watched a few fights for comparison. It just isn't the same. I don't know what it is. And also the quality of the knockout in the first fight for Rose Namajunas. It was just like low kick, low kick, low kick, high kick. See you later, mate. Absolutely turned her lights out. But can we discount Usman Covington too? Come on, that was an absolute classic, the first fight. But the unknown quantity on the card, in the main card at least, is Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler. I mean, two wrestlers who love to strike. We said it before about Michael Chandler when he fought for the title against Oliveira. He's like a lit stick of dynamite, ready to go off at any time. And to be honest with you, if it wasn't Charles Oliveira in the opposite corner, someone with so much experience from an early age in the UFC, he's got like 10 losses on his record, who hadn't seen everything, I thought he would have beat pretty much any lightweight in the world on that night. Him against Gaethje is going to be nuts. But yeah, that's the UFC. Keeps giving us quality content week in, week out. We hear that the fighters are underpaid. I don't know if that's actually true.
But back-to-back weeks, how can they have back-to-back blockbuster weeks in the sport and then not be paying their athletes? You know, it's just incredible. I don't think there's any sport that's delivering up this sort of content in back-to-back weeks. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, to be honest with you, it's really difficult to compare it to boxing because everything's in-house. But unlike last weekend, we've got something special to look forward to in the world of boxing. As Saul Canelo Alvarez looks to become undisputed super middleweight champion against Caleb Plant, whose IBF title remains the only thing missing from the Mexican's growing collection. Plant is undefeated in 21 fights. He's slick and he can go 12 rounds no problem. He's also earned the moniker in certain circles of the blackest man in boxing because he's like, he's mixed race, but to a really diluted degree. And he just looks like a white guy, but people call him the blackest man in boxing. But to be honest with you, Plant's absolutely fucked here. He's dead man walking. He's Undertaker 2002. There's no chance, man. There's absolutely no chance of him beating Canelo. They came together at the press conference. Canelo slipped and clipped him just like it was nothing. He split his cheek open in 5 seconds. I shudder to think what he'd be able to do over 12 rounds. Canelo is a man at the peak of his powers, and I would genuinely be shocked if he doesn't win on Saturday.
I'm going to have to let sentiment get the better of me and not disagree with you. I'm not going to disagree with your opinions on boxing, but I'm going to hope that he can do something. He can cause an upset in this, because obviously we spoke about Caleb before and like the issues he's had in his life and how much adversity he's had to come through. Obviously, this guy has had an awful life really up to this point, and he's had to fight hard for everything. His daughter, Alaya, suffered an unknown medical condition, resulting in her death at the age of 19 months. And later on in his life, his mother, Beth, was shot by police after apparently pulling a knife on an officer. And so both of this has happened by the age of 27, and she later died in hospital. So I know the odds are stacked against him, but I'm rooting for this guy all day long on Saturday evening, man. He told Showtime's All Access cameras ahead of the fight, "I have conquered things way bigger than boxing, things that would chew Alvarez up and spit him out, and I've come out here with my chin up." He knows what he's got in front of me. He knows what he's got in front of him, and he's just another guy to me. So like, I'm just hoping that, you know, that's got to tickle your fancy, boys. Come on, let's hope he can cause an upset.
Even you just saying that to me, I've got all the sympathy in the world for him, man. I can't imagine what that would be like to go through that shit before you're 27. But when I hear fighters talking about things like that, it automatically sets alarm bells ringing in my head. This is a matter of technique, skill, and durability. And Canelo is probably the most ice-cold fighter. He's very like Petr Yan in that respect. He's going to find the gaps and he's going to find them and he's going to punish you for presenting them to him. And also, you said right at the top of the pod about Pogba, Flynn, he's someone who thrives under pressure. He actually loves it. Like he wants the mantle of being the best in boxing on his shoulders. He wants to chase undisputed titles. Your man started at 154. He's now fighting at 168. He's battered everyone he's fought since Mayweather. And he's no stranger to the kind of problems that Caleb Plant's been through. Don't forget, before the Rocky Fielding fight 2 or 3 years ago, a 2-round demolition job of one of our world champions, his brother was kidnapped and held for ransom. He didn't even look. These are Mexicans, man. They're not fucking around. They'll chop your head off and roll it through a disco. That's actually happened. Like, so he's gone through fight preparation. He's gone through all the media. He's gone through all of that. Didn't say a word about it. Pulled off a clinical performance. And then he came out like 2 years later when someone was chatting to him from like ES News or something. Like, this guy, he's no stranger to those kind of problems himself. But at the end of it, you're dealing with a man in his prime. You are, and he's a destructive puncher. His counter punching is unreal. His head movement's off the charts. His chin's unreal. Your man went 24 rounds with Gennady Golovkin. Didn't go down once. Come on, man. We're talking facts or what?
So where's this fight going to be? Is this in Vegas?
I think this is in Vegas, yeah.
So it's sure. going to be... So I don't know, the UFC, is that going to be on the same time as UFC or what?
There'll be a bit of difference, I think. I think the UFC will start earlier.
Hopefully, man. Yeah, hopefully, because that'd be... you need to be able to catch both of those, don't you, on a Saturday night?
It's usually a Sunday thing for me, man. A Sunday, especially when it's at those times. But yeah, I'm going to... amped for the main fights on the UFC, man. What do you think, Flynn? What are you most looking forward to?
I'm hyped up to Gaethje. Love watching that dude fight. Gaethje all the way for me this weekend.
What about you, Bissett?
Yeah, I've got the missus interested in the Rose Namajunas Zhang Weili fight. So we're gonna be hyped for that. We've been just looking at ticket prices because we first looked at them. Obviously, it's in Madison Square Garden. So when we first looked, it was like $800 each. And we're like, what? But I checked yesterday. And they're down to $250 each now. So if they get to $300 for both, I'm going to check tomorrow. If they go to $300 for both, might have to snap up the tickets, man. I've had my jab now as well, so I'm allowed in.
He's allowed in. He's going to drop dead at the door, but he's allowed in.
So that'd be incredible, man. Absolutely incredible. We're definitely going to paint our faces in China flags and get beat up. But it should
Mate, please do that and take pictures before you go while you're there. Give us the full documentation because I would fucking love that, man. Chinese fucking face paint. That'd be sick.
Hilarious, man. Absolutely hilarious. But yeah, now that was a wicked, wicked episode, lads. Good to do the three-way ball chat. For once, obviously, we did it with Tino, first time with you, Flynn. And it might be a four-way next week, possibly. Will it be with your mate? We can get your mate on the podcast. He used to play
Nicholas Jackson.
Yeah, Nicholas Jackson used to play for Manchester United in the academy until the age of 16. Played a little bit of college soccer over here with it, and he got a scholarship. I'm not sure which team, but we'll sort of go through that with him next week. But hopefully, he should be on, and it should be a really fun episode.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
Can't wait. I mean, he'll really be loving the Ronaldo fellatio, and he'll be loving that more than most of us. So,
and digging out McFred as well. He's already said that he hates McFred as well. So,
McFred,
yeah, McTominay and Fred. So, they're going to be in for another digging out, they're going to be in for another slating from the ball chat.
Well, Flynn, it's been a pleasure to share an episode with you finally. I know we've been talking about it for a long time. So glad to have you on. Let's make it as regular as it can possibly be, man. I'm so ambitious. Thank you to you as well for moving things along in my absence and in my desire to take a step away for a few weeks. I miss it more and more. Every time I listen to an episode or every time I'm not involved, I do miss it. It is just a time thing. And hopefully we can keep this going as much as we can.
Absolutely. Cheers, boys. Have a good few drinks tonight and I will see you next week.